Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
We apologize for some of the technical issues we had today. There's a garbled audio at a few points, but the podcast as a whole still is excellent information and a great show. Thanks. Hello, welcome back to Cypherpunk. This is Hero White. Today we have a special guest with us from the Mononet Project. Aram Sinra, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, welcome to the show. We ran across, yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we ran across your project. Well, I'm not sure exactly where I ran across it, but it's within our search terms and interests. Any of the listeners on the show, you have this project where you're looking at creating a highly decentralized P2P network that is not based on the current infrastructure, but is an actual, completely separate physical infrastructure to the. It's an infrastructure that's separate from all the cables and wires that are out there now. So it's very different from the I2P and Tor and other darknet type systems. Am I correct with that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we kind of backed into the data rather than starting with the idea of, you know, hey, let's build a whole new network, which is, you know, obviously a colossal undertaking. My background personally is in critical and cultural studies for the most part, and also to a certain degree in internet business and cultural analysis. So for many years, and I published last year called Mashed Up, which looks at mashup culture and its kind of role in helping to people to reimagine what society is going to look like in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And so I was interested for a long time in the kind of capacity for these new media technologies to redefine the kind of battle between regulation and resistance in the cultural sphere. But the more I looked at it, the more I realized that, you know, that battle itself was kind of constrained and overdetermined by the battles that were going on in Washington and in WIPO about the use of intellectual property and you know, people's freedom to express themselves via all these emerging channels, and the kind of delta between what we traditionally think of as, you know, as free speech or as privacy or as any of the other kind of core civil liberties as they're embodied in physical space, and this more, you know, vastly limited version of those civil liberties as they're enacted in cyberspace. So I became more and more involved in the kind of politics of online expression, looking at, you know, both kind of copyright and also stuff like the Great Firewall of China, or you know, the the ways in which the internet was taken offline in places like Iran, and Libya. And the more I began to look at it, the more I realized that the problem wasn't actually a cultural problem or a problem of regulation. You know, at the heart of it, there's a problem with the network itself, right? Which is that the centralization, the extreme centralization of the internet, the fact that, you know, no matter how many billions of people, and at this point it's 2 billion people around the world who are connected, are sharing information laterally or rhizomatically directly with one another, they're all passing through the eye of the needle, right? Yeah. There is one highly concentrated infrastructure that's controlled by a handful of companies who are really, you know, have to play nice with the governments in whatever regions they're in, you know, witness, you know, Google and China, for instance, right? So, or BlackBerry and the kind of obeisances that they've made to, like, the UAE.
Yeah.
So it occurred to me that as long as the infrastructure is this exploitable, it will be exploited, just like power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. You know, power to control speech will corrupt the political process.
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of got to the point logically where it occurred to me that the only meaningful intervention or a requisite meaningful intervention would be to reimagine the network as something that's fundamentally decentralized and thus non-exploitable. I know that's a long answer to your question, but I kind of had to get there through the, you know, the logical train of thought that took me there.
Oh, that was a fantastic answer. And it fits right in with a lot of projects that we have been covering. And it's this idea, it goes alongside also a lot of the ideas with agorism itself, and that is you look at creating structural solutions rather than going and trying to vote the certain things into, you know, like you said, like policy or something like that. Even if you go in and you do vote policy, you still leave the guy. All you've done is you've created a situation where you have some dear leader who has the big red internet kill button switch sitting right next to him, but he's legally bound not to use it under most certain types of situations. And we all know how these constitutional loopholes and stuff are used and abused. And so as long as that button's there, then you're going to be possibly put into the same situation overtly, or it's going to happen covertly. Because even in all of these countries that have that supposedly have rock solid laws in place and people are not supposed to abuse the system, you have these intelligence agencies and the rest of them that are just doing everything covertly. So the only way is this approach that you're taking. Now, a lot of us are working on projects or interested in them and following them that are trying to do the same way on top of the other systems. What's fantastic about this is that when it sidesteps the current infrastructure, you're talking about a whole different set of solutions, and you're bypassing so many of the problems that they're trying to solve based upon operating a decentralized P2P system that solves a lot of these problems on top of a very centralized system. Now, let me start off with a few questions I have right now. MondoNet, is this a project? Do you have software? Is it an organization? Is it a think tank? What are you guys, what are you doing?
Great question. Okay, so there are two aspects to MondoNet. And first of all, I'm a Rutgers professor in the School of Communication and Information in the Department of Journalism and Media Studies. And this began, well, this has been kind of something that's been sitting in the back of my mind since about 2003 when I first read Tim Wu on Net Neutrality. Obviously, the concept of a decentralized network is something that's been bat around for even longer than that. But this, the MondoNet project, began within my department with me and two of my graduate students, Nathan Graham and Aaron Trammell. And the first phase, which we've completed, is essentially making the argument that I have made to you, but in a well-researched, well-cited, technologically explored way, and coming up with a series of what we call 10 social specifications, just like you'd have tech specs for for a new project, we think that, you know, it's important to inject the kind of social mandate into the debate, because too often technologies kind of get built by engineers who don't have that social perspective. And what you end up with is platforms in search of a use, or even worse, platforms that are rife with capacities for social exploitation, because the engineers hadn't really thought through the potential uses of the platform when they built it. So what we came up with was a set of these, you know, 10 criteria that are essential to any network that is going to enable free and open and democratic, if you like that word, communications between any two people or any 10 million people around the globe. And it's a call to arms, really, to the engineering community to create platforms that meet those specifications. Now, the second phase, which is what, and we're about to publish an article summing up those specifications in a journal called The Information Society. That should be published in July. Now, the second phase is what we're just beginning now. And what we want to do is we think that we have an idea about how to build a network that achieves those specifications that would be relatively easy to engineer and accessible to any person around the globe, essentially on any platform, as long as they're within networking range of somebody else. We're in the process of, when you're at a university, getting funding is a huge cluster F. So we're in the process of making that funding material. But what we wanted to do is build an actual software package that could be under license, so it would be completely accessible to the code community, whatever. But the fundamental function of the software package, you download a networkable device like an iPad or an iPhone or an iPod or any kind of laptop or tablet or mobile device. And what it does is it looks for other peers within direct networking range. That is via Wi-Fi, via Bluetooth, via WiMAX, whatever the native capacity of the device is, that's what it uses. And it builds a direct connection, not using an ISP, not using a phone carrier, but a direct wireless connection to that other device. And in aggregate, all of the devices connecting to one another create a large and stable mesh. And that mesh exists in a perpetual state regardless of whether peer X comes online or goes offline, or peer Y comes online or goes offline.
Okay. Can I pause now, you for a second?
Go ahead.
Okay, because we're flying along here, and I want to back up a little bit, and then we start getting into the how the infrastructure works and then current ideas of some of the protocols. Can we jump into these principles real quick? Are these 10 principles the same?
Yeah, of course.
The one that you said you're going to release this document, are these the same ones on the wiki page and the PDF? Let's start off with decentralized.
Yes, they are.
Okay. Why don't we fly through those real quick so people can understand your goals, and that'll help us understand more as you start getting into the technical stuff.
Okay, sounds good. So just to go through, you know, we kind of jokingly call them the Ten Commandments, but the 10 social specifications for a democratized network. The first one is decentralization. And the key there is that, you know, the most exploitable factor of the current network infrastructure is, like I said, that it's an eye of the needle, that there's a handful of companies responsible for the vast majority of infrastructure connecting any two users to one another. So the network, as built, has to be something that cannot possibly be effectively monopolized or oligopolized or cartelized by large consolidated interests. The second social specification is that it's got to be universally accessible. And that means a number of different things. First of all, it means that it's the price point has to be cheap or free. And that's part of the reason why we're not proposing to distribute, you know, dedicated hardware like the FreedomBox or the, you know, OLPC or something like that. This should be something that can be freely downloaded and installed on anyone's pre-existing hardware. So, you know, it's as cheap to implement as, you know, Mozilla. And it should also be accessible in the sense that, you know, the learning curve should not be too steep. It should be multilingual, multi-regional, accessible in different kinds of political and environmental climates, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
Third is it's got to be sense-proof. That is to say that architecturally it should be impossible for any third party to interrupt your ability to add information to the network, to share a specific piece of information with somebody else, or to exclude any community from participating in the network, or to render the network itself inoperable. Right? So it's got to be invulnerable to you know, DDoS attacks and whatever. Fourth, it's got surveillance proof, which is to say, if I want to communicate with you in a private manner, and I don't want somebody eavesdropping on my conversations, I have to have that capacity. And furthermore, I want to say something publicly, but I want to stay anonymous. You know, think WikiLeaks, Bradley Manning. I should have that technological capacity very easily and transparently to make myself unsurveillable and anonymous.
Okay, great.
Fifth, it should be secure. And security obviously means both, you know, being resilient to malicious hacks and attacks, but also secure in the kind of fundamental sense of there is, you know, structural integrity to the network. It's not going to crash every time somebody tries to use it, or every time the network size exceeds a certain threshold or something like that.
Yeah.
People have to be able to count on the fact that it's there. Sixth, it's got to be scalable. So this is something that should be able to work for 10 people in a building together or 10 million people around the globe together. And that's actually, from an engineering standpoint, probably the greatest challenge that we still face. But it's over time, it becomes a trivial challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Number seven, it's got to be permanent. So the network has to, even if individuals are constantly going to join and exit, the network itself has to be there. People need to know that they'll be able to get in touch with it when they need it, that the information they want is going to be available on the network when they need it, and that, you know, just being within range of one other user will open you up to the entire field of users. Eighth, it's got to be fast enough. And this is an interesting question, is what is fast enough? Obviously, although, you know, the U.S. is now lagging in terms of average broadband speeds, you know, we're seeing a continual, you know, nearly Moore's Law style curve in terms of the speed of accessibility that people have to the internet, and we're building applications, you know, as fast as the network will allow that exploit this. So, you know, right now we have movies on demand on Netflix. That's turning into HD movies on demand. Pretty soon we'll have 3D HD movies on demand. You know, Google's experimenting with this gigabit service to the home in the Midwest right now. I've heard tell of gigabit Wi-Fi that's being tested. So the goal of MondoNet is not to compete with the commercial internet for speed, right?
Right.
There's no way that we could do that. The reality is that fiber to the home is awesome. You know, I have Fios at home, and that's what is allowing us to have this conversation. But the minimum required speed to participate in the political process is achievable, and it's a moving target. So 10 years ago, that would have been being able to post and load web pages.
Uh-huh.
Today, I would argue that it means being able to have a Skype call.
Okay.
Or to stream audio or video. 10 years from now, that will obviously be something completely different, and the minimum required speed will have something to do with live streaming location-aware services, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we don't, you know, as well as biometric and other kinds of sensor net accessibility. But that's a moving target, and fortunately the technology will provide as we scale up. The ninth social specification is independence, which is to say that the network can use other networks. We can piggyback on the internet. We can piggyback on cell phone networks. We can piggyback on the sneaker net.
Ah.
But if every other network in the world goes down, MondoNet has to be able to stand independently of all those other networks. It's
okay.
Got to be you need to be able to go into a post-tsunami, war-torn nuclear fallout zone and set up a MondoNet relatively easily.
Yeah. Okay.
And then tenth, the network has to be evolvable. So you have to build with the expectation that you know, you're not trying to solve today's problems, but also provide a platform for people to solve tomorrow's problems.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like I said, we don't know what the fast enough means in 10 years, but we also don't know what the political climate will be. We don't know what kinds of information are going to be politically volatile. And so you need to incorporate technical standards that have the capacity to be extended, built upon, reimagined, reused, tweaked, modified, and augmented over in the future without either running into intellectual property or engineering problems that can't be overcome.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great.
So those are the 10 social specifications.
Yeah, that's quite a tall order, but I think that this is all doable, with the stuff that's happening right now and the technology development and the several projects that have come up with certain solutions to many parts of this. And of course, none of them are solving all of them. They solve different problems. Are you looking at existing software projects right now that you find certain aspects fascinating that could be that you want to
absolutely
draw from?
Yeah, I mean, there are, look, we're not engineers, right? We're social scientists and critical scholars. And so we don't want, and obviously in our funded project, we're going to be hiring some engineers. And if there's anybody out there who has special expertise in mesh networking, please feel free to contact us at mononet.org. We are going to be relying as much as possible on openly licensed technology developed outside of our own project. And, there are a bunch of mobile ad hoc satellites that have built, their own set of protocols and are kind of in ongoing development. There's the Serval project. I mentioned the Freedom Box Initiative, which is what Evan Moglen is working on at Columbia. Mm-hmm. So, and we've recently, we've met, partially thanks to this little TED Talk that I did a few weeks ago, we've met a bunch of fellow travelers who are working in parallel on projects that we can incorporate into MondoNet. And, we're starting to become aware of one another. This is really an idea that it's like calculus or whatever, that's in the ether because it's the right time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people who thought they were independently siloed working on addressing these problems are beginning to discover one another. And, maybe we'll even have a conference or some kind of event where we can network in person sometime in the next year or two.
Okay, great. We did a show last week on Bitcoin over Freenet, and in there we talked about this ability to operate the Bitcoin system even if there was a complete internet shutdown switch, and the guest DA2CE, I forget his little name, NIM there, I can never remember it without having it on my screen, he talked about how the Freenet system has the cache where you can, with some slight modification, you can run Freenet through Sneakernet, where people with USB sticks, just every time they meet up with a friend at the coffee shop, they exchange USB sticks, and they resync their caches. And how after a couple of days of this, you could have a, if enough people were doing it worldwide, you could have a verified payments happening.
Hey, I lost you for a second. So the last thing I heard was the coffee shop.
I just losing off the top of my head what part of what I was mentioning something about coffee shop. I'll just back up a little bit. The Freenet over Bitcoin, you heard me mention that? I mean Bitcoin over Freenet?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so the idea
is saying Bitcoin and it works with Sneakernet.
Yeah, so you just sync up your USB stick with a friend. You just exchange USB sticks and you plug it into your machine and your caches sync up and you continue to do that. And through this 6 degrees of separation type thing, over a period of a couple of days, you have a network which is exchanging information worldwide and doing Bitcoin transactions. But maybe you'll have a two-day delay in getting a transaction cleared. But what was fascinating was this type of an idea of how to operate in a system where there are zero communication links happening. So,
yeah, no, I think never underestimate the value of Sneakernet. Remember that in the Soviet era, Samizdat was all Sneakernet, and it was phenomenally influential in terms of the political process. We played a role in, eventually carrying on the Iron Curtain. So you know, the other thing to point out is that, you know, technologies are great, but you need human beings behind them in order for them to you know, help human society to develop and achieve its ends. So, you know, the actual human beings on the ground, building networks and communicating with one another is has got to be the foundation of any network. And I think that's nothing that a lot of engineers, not all engineers, kind of forget, is that the human operator is part of the system. So, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, there's an artist who said that there needs to be dongles in brick walls around major cities. I don't remember the artist's name.
Yeah.
But I thought that was an interesting project, too. Of course, you know, that's kind of like an information glory hole. You know, bugs you're going to pick up by sticking your machine in. But you know, I think that any MondoNet implementation would have to have both synchronous and asynchronous, right? And Sneakernet, by definition, is asynchronous. So there has to be some kind of queuing protocol that will cache, packets and then release them when network is present.
Yeah, what was interesting about his idea on using the way that FreeNet works is that Sneakernets in the past tend to be based upon, you know, you put files on a stick and you take them to someone else and then they copy those files over. And in the FreeNet system, it actually is just a big cache of random data, and you exchange those back and forth. And as a whole, with enough people doing this, you wind up having gigabytes of emails and communications and files and video and all of this stuff just transferring worldwide without there being anybody coordinating the individual things that they're exchanging. So, yeah, and that software
doesn't. Yeah, I like that idea a lot. I
mean, yeah, what's nice about it too is that it's a very Mad Max like scenario to think, because a lot of people say, well, you can't beat the NSA and you can't do this, but you have to go all the way back if you start thinking of what if it was 1984 and the NSA did have all the superpowers, way more than we could ever imagine. You know, where could we start in that type of a system? And then go from there.
You don't even have to imagine, you know, like some like American dystopian future. I mean, there are plenty of states right now under severe informatic lockdown. So, I mean, you know, there are hundreds of millions of people right now living under political repression that prevents them from participating in this. And all you have to do is you can talk to people from the sites and communities and then ask them, you know, what they, you know, how effective various modes of information transfer are and what they'd like to see in order to share information more effectively.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's...
But yeah, I'm...
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. I think we have a lag of
a
second.
Yeah, yeah. There was an article that was thrown up by Dave Weiner the other day. And it was mentioning this trend that some people are trying to push where there's browsers that do not have the location bar in them, the URL, where you enter your URL. Mm-hmm. And he was commenting about a friend. They were visiting some country, and there was these blocks of houses that were set up, these little bungalows, and they were all empty. And no one wanted to rent from them. And come to find out, it was because they didn't have back doors. And I think it was they were designed by somebody and it was related with they were Cubans or something. I don't remember the deal, but the point was, I think that these people were from a place where they weren't going to have a house that didn't have a back door, and it's not necessarily, I don't know how that's related to this, but in a way it is, just in terms of there's a lot of places out there that they're. That you can look at where you just don't realize how important it is to have certain forms of communication and methods of doing stuff. And in that situation, it was, you know, they're used to living in some type of a police state where, you know, guys are going to come knocking on their door and they may need to run out the back. It was actually endemic to the culture itself, not just a, you know, thing for criminals. So.
Right. And that comes back to the kind of like Lawrence Lessig observation that Coase's law, right? So, you know, and you get that point more about the architecture's law. If your house has a back door, then when the police come to the front, you can run out the back. If it doesn't, you're pretty much screwed. And that's not in, you know, that's not a, up to the agency of the occupant of the house. It's the power resides in the architect of the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, these people you're talking about, they, the only choice they had was, you know, to not live in a house without a back door.
Right.
But notice that they can afford to not live in the internet's house, because that's the only house going.
Yeah. Oh, now I remember why I brought it up specifically. It was because Weiner said that for him, that's what he feels that the browser location bar is. He said, that is our back door. That is our ability to that we have to know that someone else is not going to be able to control all the different places that we can or can't go. As long as we have that URL location bar, then we can choose where we want to go. And that was his point
Though, you know, unfortunately, he's only partially right.
Partially correct.
Because, of course, because the location bar, unless you know IP addresses off the top of your head, the location bar is for domain names. And whoever controls the DNS lookup is really the one whether you have access to the back door or not.
Yeah.
And more and more, we're being seen not just abroad dictatorial environments, but also in the U.S., we're seeing a push to force ISPs to police all manner of alleged malfeasance by severing domains from their IP addresses and essentially censoring entire servers from the U.S. public without their knowledge or consent.
Yeah,
and that was in the quick.
A lot of it's happening without even due process. The Homeland Security is just seizing these domains based upon their own little guidance, even sites that don't even have copyright stuff on it, that they're linking to other sites. And what I saw yesterday was a new law that's being put out in the U.S., which is taking this ability to seize the domain names further in order to demand that ISPs also, so, you know, it's getting down to the, close to the where it's working. Before, they were just seizing the domain names, and then they were putting up other domain names at, for the same IP, the guys operating the sites. Now they're looking at censoring the...
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
At the ISP level for IPs themselves, right? And then the new law in the U.S. actually then is starting to put some type of injunctions or restrictions on search engines. I don't even know how they're going to define a search engine. I mean, is a search engine any page where you can type something in and it pulls up results? Is that an engine? I mean, how much crawling that has to be done before? It's just funny how these guys are coming up with these laws. The other day I was talking with a friend about URLs, and it's like, you know, you make a law against linking to something. Well, what is linking? It's referencing something. So if I say there's something on the Disney.com website in the kids section, did I just give a URL? I mean, was that illegal for me to reference a location, or is it illegal to have like a literal link there? And is that just to specify, you know, machine-readable links? Or if we just start come up with a protocol for natural language URLs, Will that be included? You know, it's something else.
No, the law that you're talking about is called the Protect IP Bill. Actually, they tried to, the Senate introduced a similar bill last year called COICA, COICA, mm-hmm. and it never made it through the whole process whereby in law. This one addresses superfluously addressed some of the concerns that that COICA's critics had, but retains that that requirement that. That ISPs and other service operators essentially, you know, restrict people's access to different domains without even their knowledge or consent, and without due process, as you point out. And what's interesting is actually, you know, the group Anonymous, I'm sure.
Yeah.
They have announced that they're attacking the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's website today. The IP bill. So you know, this is an issue that's heating up. It's a very, very sensitive political issue, and you know, I spent a lot of time speaking to both proponents and opponents of measures like this, and what the proponent, you're not a criminal, you've got nothing to worry about argument. You know, we're only going after these people who are sharing millions of Hollywood movies and Adobe software and stealing people's identities and doing the bad stuff that hurts everybody. And it's in everyone's best interest for us to go to the choke point, which is the ISP or the domain name registrar or the search engine, and, you know, with one fell swoop, preventing the people from being able to access this stuff. Now, the opponents of these measures say, well, that's all well and good, but we have to trust, you know, the Department of Justice or whoever it is that's going to be maintaining the blacklist and issuing the orders to the service providers to our interest. And given the fact that, you know, let's take a decade of illegal NSA wiretaps, you know, in direct contravention of FISA laws,
yeah,
which are supposed to protect people's privacy and security. You know, we're not so confident,
yeah,
that the U.S. government or any centralized authority is going to continue to work in our best interest. I mean, if they work in our best interest 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100,
yeah,
there's going to be that one example when it matters the most, when, you know, not having the power to determine what information we can and can't access is going to work against us as a society and undermine the democratic political process.
Right.
So, you know, and this is, it's very complex, and unfortunately it's so complex that most Americans are completely unaware that these, you know, these serious issues are being worked out through the legislature at the moment, because most journalists don't really know how to cover the story.
Well, this,
you know, you don't want to sound like a whack.
I'm sorry, they're breaking up a little bit too there. This is part of the problem too, is when you said Americans aren't aware of this stuff being worked out by legislators, is that the solutions, the tyranny is being done by these guys, but what they're trying to do is they're trying to come up with solutions. So even if the people that are against this, they want solutions, and they're going for legal solutions also. Is that's very nationalistic or national centric, okay? Because in the U.S. they may come up with all these safeguards and da 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 and all this, and everything is being taken care of by top men, and no systems being abused. Okay, what technology is being done, is being used to do this? What, Cisco? Oh, where does Cisco send these same routers? They're being sent to all kinds of countries, the same technology that they're using to do the things that they want to do in the U.S. right now, but they're very limited to in some ways. The other guys in other countries aren't being limited at all, and you're seeing totalitarian regimes even become even stronger foothold, and tyranny growing worse against the people. So the solutions that you're looking at with the MondoNet, it works at more of a structural level. It doesn't just bypass your local politician. It gives people, individuals, to bypass all politicians in all of their jurisdictions, and instead of hoping that their guy is going to, like, not abuse the system, because they are abusing it in other countries, and their Americans don't have a solution to that except what, go over there and invade and import their own democracy, which doesn't work either. So.
Right. And you know, what's funny is that at the same as we, the U.S., are working very hard to export our information policies, including restrictive information policies, to the rest of the world, using threats of trade sanctions and other kinds of economic leverage to impose these kinds of policies on countries that, you know, unquestionably will not benefit from adopting them. We are also promoting something called Internet Freedom, which Secretary of State Hillary Clinton outlined in a February speech, in which we assert that access to the Internet and access to knowledge and information is a fundamental human right in accordance with the basic tenets of American democracy, and that we will actively seek to promote these values abroad. So it's we're kind of speaking out of both sides of our mouths, and it's, you know, if I were in a foreign sovereignty and I were trying to figure out, you know, what our information policy, what our IP policy is going to be, or even, you know, if I were a political actor in one of the countries, I was going to figure out, you know, the best way for me to participate in the political, I would be very confused about the messages that the U.S. is happening yet. I don't want to be cynical and say that we are, you know, just on what's an evil policy, but I do think that we're fundamentally conflicted.
Well, I think that I think it's conflicted for a lot of the people. I don't think that some of the people who are working on some of these policies, what they're kind of conflicted about is this. It's about their policy. They're very clear on technology. For them, the policy is they need to have the ability to do anything and everything that they want to do, but they need to have legal limitations on what they need to do, okay? And other countries, too, they're trying to say, you need to be better with your people. You need to allow them to do these things. Whereas in your system, you're not looking at any type of a policy change, exporting some type of a policy. You're actually saying, hey, here's the tools that just do it, which is why, I mean, you hear what Hillary Clinton has to say, but you'd think that you guys would be getting a check from the State Department for some funding real soon. But I don't think that is going to happen in any way unless you guys had some type of a back door in your system or centralized control, or this technology could be exported and it could be used, but it also, you know, it's not going to allow terrorists to communicate with each other, or, I mean, that's just extreme example, or people to be able to pirate. So, anyway, let's move on here to technological stuff.
Yeah,
do you guys have...
unfortunately, you're...
What's that? What was the last thing?
I was going to say, unfortunately, you're right about the back door. That's the outspoken policy of the Obama White House, is that any platform provider, communications platform provider, has to have a back door that's accessible to intelligence agencies in order to police for, you know, any kind of prohibited speech, essentially. It's not law yet, but Obama has personally asked Congress to draft laws that include that backdoor provision in them. And it's a policy that we've enforced in various ways going back for a long, long time. And the argument is that it's tantamount to, you know, wiretapping a phone call. And since we've been able to do that, since there were phones, we should be able to tap any other information stream. But of course, you know, wiretapping a phone call in 1970 required, you know, a single agent to listen to a single call between two people, whereas you can, you know, have a bot without an agent behind it monitoring and filtering billions and billions of information exchanges over a virtual platform, which really shifts the balance of power to the regulators to a tremendous degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're not identical from a political standpoint.
Oh yeah, no, it's a completely. We could just talk for a long time on the history of that and how they've been enabled through accidents in the way that the technology works, not because it was implemented because of some policy, and just because they can, they want to, and they think it's their right because they can. Well, you know, if they think that what they can do, their rights are based upon what they can do, I think that a global MondoNet system will show them what their rights really are. Let's get into the technical stuff here. Do you guys have any working systems? You mentioned Batman. What kind of hardware are you going to end up being able to use these GL54G the Linksys routers and install their firmware? Or what kind of stuff you got going on in your thinking for?
Well, in our thinking, let me emphasize again, you know, the first phase of MondoNet involved technological feasibility analysis, but we don't yet have an engineer on board. Okay. Fortunately, one of my grad students has a coding background, so he's able to do a lot of the kind of vetting of what's out there. But what we really need at this point is to hire a networking engineer who can address the kind of nitty-gritty technical issues. But as far as what kinds of networking protocols uses of spectrum we think would be appropriate, obviously Wi-Fi is probably the number one infrastructural protocol that we would use. And the reason for that is that, you know, Wi-Fi is interesting because it's, you know, it's crap bandwidth. There's the reason that it's been unlicensed in so many countries, and it's because you can't use it for any. You know, it's it only travels 200 feet. It's very easy to interfere with. So it's great for having a router in your house, but it's terrible for being the infrastructure for a large scale commercial project.
Okay.
You know, WiMAX or something like that is much better for that. But we think Wi-Fi makes sense precisely because it is junk bandwidth. In virtually every nation around the world, Wi-Fi is unlicensed, the same set of unlicensed spectrum, the same frequencies that are filled with billions and billions of communications from different kinds of devices. And therefore, MondoNet traffic would get lost in the haystack in those frequency bands. It would be very difficult to track down MondoNet peers and eliminate them. And in fact, we envision making it even more difficult, a few orders of magnitude, by introducing non-human operated peers into the MondoNet network. Now, what that means specifically is, what that would mean specifically would be, let's say that my iPhone and your laptop were connecting and becoming two connected MondoNet peers. Within my vicinity, there would also be five MondoNet routers, rebroadcasters that don't have human beings attached to them, that would be boosting the strength of the signal, but also making it more difficult for regulators to figure out which peer is connected to a human operator. Okay. And we envision those router nodes being very cheap to manufacture. We're talking like $5 or $10, and all it is is an antenna with a little chip running the firmware, and maybe like a rare earth magnet or a piece of duct tape, so you can throw it up behind a stop sign or under a truck or in a trash can somewhere, and you distribute them to college kids or whoever the young people are in the society that or community that you're addressing. And on an ongoing basis, they continue to just litter the environment with these peers.
Oh, that is absolutely fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so we think that'll address a lot of the kind of tracking down the signal issues. Now, that being said, I think ideally, MondoNet should be able to take advantage of any wireless networking protocol that's available. So if you have a device that can use WiMAX, it should be able to broadcast, send and receive on WiMAX. If you've got a device that can use Bluetooth, it should be able to scan and see if there are any other ready peers with Bluetooth range. It should not, to the greatest extent possible, MondoNet should be protocol agnostic, so that it will have as many possible avenues of information sharing as possible. This is something that we've talked about a lot. Right now, at the moment, there is a technological limit as to how large a mesh network can be and still be at least minimally efficient. And that's somewhere in the range of 1,000 or 2,000 nodes, which is great if you're talking about a college campus or a small city, but it doesn't work for New York or Beijing, or Tehran. And so what we envision in the kind of phase one rollout of MondoNet would be using longer distance networks like the internet as a kind of band-aid to patch together different local instantiations of MondoNet meshes. Yeah. And that essentially what would happen is at that gateway between MondoNet and the internet, the packets would all be encrypted with the MondoNet specific key. And then, when they get passed on to other MondoNet, mega peers or whatever you want to call those meshes that all have that point of presence of the internet, it gets decrypted back into the MondoNet protocols and redistributed within that local peer. So that's kind of like the internet equivalent of that sneaker net network that we were talking about before. But as long as it's traveling over internet, it's fully encrypted, which makes it more censorable. But there are ways to deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, you're dealing. It's like a high speed gate. It's like a high speed inter gateway, or I can't think of the word right now. There are people doing stuff like this for VPNs. You'll have your local network, and then you'll have your remote network, and it'll be connected to a VPN link, and be traffic filter that happens so that only certain traffic goes between the two networks. So a lot of stuff is being done in different solutions for different problems, and
It's really great. You know, back to your disposable radio thing. Some of us have been talking about this with using these things for pirate radio. They found in the past 6 months or so, a couple places in California, these pirate radio stations that were being run out of a little like air conditioning unit on top of a high rise apartment complex, and all that was inside of the the little air conditioning unit was a Wi-Fi box, and I think it had like a not a 3G, but it was a Wi-Fi, basically an access point that was set up, connected to a little digital to audio converter that was plugged into an FM transmitter, and they were stealing power from the air conditioning unit, and it was doing FM yep. Radio broadcasting. Now, when that thing was raided and taken down, they were at a complete loss as to who it was broadcasting, whereas in other situations, come to the radio station and seize everybody's computer equipment, whether it was used or in an operation of it or not, maybe arrest somebody or fine or whatever. So, you know, we were talking about what is the cost for that. You know, you have to get down. Well, you could do like a 3G phone with unlimited data or a decent data plan that would last for streaming a low bandwidth. So you'd have to buy the phone. You have to get a data plan under some fake ID or something. I mean, you know, what would be the cost to put up some type of thing? And what we were talking about is that as time goes on over the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, the miniaturization and cost of some of this technology is so super low. So you're talking like bucks or so for one of these little repeater devices. And, you know, if these things are disposable,
that's absolutely right.
You know, I mean,
that's absolutely right. And remember, they're going to be building networking capacity, specifically Wi-Fi capacity, but also RFID and Bluetooth into everything over the next 10 years, because the commercial plan is to have smart living rooms, smart kitchens, smart cars. You know, the idea that when you run out of milk, your refrigerator recognizes that the unit's no longer in there, and it automatically calls your grocery store and asks them to deliver a new carton of milk. So in order to reach that, miniaturization and mass production and therefore drop in costs for network capacity, you know, is a necessity. And so I agree with you. I think that, you know, that is for both kind of Moore's law tech, but also for, you know, for commercial engineering reasons, you know, that's an inevitability. Like the power to network will be something that is, you know, borders on free in very short order.
Yeah. Do you know of any type of a term in cyberpunk or cypherpunk culture and literature, or on the net that's been used to describe some trend in technology that is tyrannical but opens up an alternative opposing force based on, like in this case, the scale of costs for manufacturing, and then how that can be used in a reverse way? I mean, I know that there's been a lot of, you know, guns can be used for tyranny and it can be used for self-defense. And sometimes there's in this case, you're thinking about a large network, Big Brother corporate government surveillance society that is coming upon us even faster due to miniaturization and the cost of these electronic devices, and then how that can be turned around for the benefit of people. But that type of have you heard of any term that is used for that?
No, I think that's something that's very coinable. You should come up with something.
Yeah, there's it seems like some
Hero's Law.
Yeah, right. There you go. Yeah. No, it's the idea that they came up with too, and some of the guys out there talking about the transparent society, whether you like it or not. In the future, the little devices that are, you know, smaller than a grain of sand, and actually smaller, they're hardly even visible, or they're not visible at all to the human eye, that are able to record video and audio and transmit them. You know, it's a nanotech world this time. And how originally people would think, oh, we're going to use this. The government thinks, oh, we'll be able to now spy on everyone. But at the same time, all of government and all of police and everybody and all politicians and criminals and other, they're all real criminals that are
you know, committing violence against people, they're being spied on also. So there's this leveling effect that starts to happen when they thought they were getting some type of an advantage. So anyway, I see that happening.
Well, there's,
go ahead.
There's an analogous process which I've been planning to write about for years, and I've never gotten around to it, but I talk about it sometimes. What I call it the inchworm effect. And the basic argument is that, you know, we create new communications technologies, and they have this first order set of effects. And we think that, you know, we extrapolate from those first order set of effects what their long-term effects on society are going to be. Uh-huh. And then we create laws, and we create regulations, and we create businesses, all with the expectation that this first order set of effects is kind of pointing the way towards, you know, the long future. And then the second order set of effects, once these first order effects kind of interact with, you know, the existing infrastructure, social, economic, engineering, the second order effects kick in, and they, of course, take things a completely different direction. Right. But by that point, we're stuck with all these laws and regulations that, you know, that got it completely wrong. And I think, you know, I see inchworm effects every day. Yeah, totally. And that doesn't direct question, directly address the question of resistance. It's something I talk about in a book, Mashed Up. You know, I think that, you know, I'm hardly the first person to point out it's kind of a foundation of, you know, Gramscian social theory that regulation and resistance in pairs. And the more of one you have, the more of the other you're going to get.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's important to emphasize, as this sometimes gets lost in these conversations, that technologies are essentially neutral, mm-hmm. right? They're not good, they're not bad, they're not liberatory, they're not fascistic. Technologies are just tools. And like anything else, like a gun, as you pointed out, or scissors, or a piece of glue, or a piece of paper, they can be used for, you know, towards any social end. And yet, as Lessig pointed out, code is law. And so the most dangerous thing where you do get the power imbalances is when people don't understand the limitations of the technologies that they're using,
yeah.
right? It's pretty easy to figure out what the scope of possibility with a piece of paper and a pencil is, right? You can write words, you can draw pictures, maybe you can poke holes in it, but that's about it. But, you know, when you're dealing with a system as complex as the internet, I mean, nobody really understands how digital networking technology works. You know, I mean, for MondoNet, I've been speaking to people who were core developers of some of the basic platforms that the internet runs on. And even these people, you know, when I talk to them and I ask them, well, you know, well, no, they get it. They get it completely, and they're enthusiastic, but they don't have all the answers. They don't know, you know, which technology would be the best to use to achieve this, the social effect of introducing that technology.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's part of this larger country that, you know, our societies are so complex that nobody understands them. There's a reason Democrats and Republicans can't agree on whether taxes is lower than them. And it's not because half of them are lying, the other telling the truth, because, you know, our economy is so complex that nobody understands how it works.
Well, you know,
and the same thing is
good
systems. Well, that's the end of my point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, I think I just heard an echo there. I think we have more like almost 3 or 4 seconds of a lag here. That's crazy. But, you know, you talked about this thing. This is why – this is part of the – if you study economic theory, Austrian economic theory, and you look at some of the stuff in the Soviet Union, and you find out that a lot of the problems with the Soviet Union were decisions being made for millions and millions of people. The problem is not that it's a totalitarian society. I mean, it's not just this buzzword. The problem is don't have the same information that the market has. So I'm just using that as an analogy that when you say government, you know, Republicans, Democrats, they can't make – yeah, exactly. They don't have that same information that a lot of people have down on the ground. And so these solutions, the real solutions are happening on the ground. And now with this whole networked world and the communications happening back and forth, I think that the problems are being strong, directly identified, and your project is doing a very good job at laying those out and setting a framework for developing solutions to these things. I would highly suggest that you guys look at coming up with an initial
platform idea and doing something like the Freedom Box people did, where they threw up, they had this idea and they threw it up for funding. And from what I remember, I think it was within the first 2 weeks or so, they had like 70, 80 grand of funding or something for an initial release. So if you guys do something like that, you know, you might be able to not have to worry about getting donations and look at people that are really going to take that start route for a solid implementation that they can start working on, you know.
Yeah, I think that's our plan, actually, is to develop a kind of moderate scale of funding and then essentially to create kind of piggyback on existing wireless networks, but require that people follow, that the machines follow rules that would actually exist if there was a mononet. Ergo, unless your iPhone sees that it's within, you know, 100 yards of someone else's iPhone, it can't receive a packet, you know, and then do a test and see and see, you know, how the mononet instantiation as we designed it would operate. And then pending the results of that, I'll go out for a large funding and try to actually build, you know, working prototype software.
Yeah, super, man. Well, I'm going to post up on the blog notes the links to the project website, and I guess you have your does the project have a Twitter feed, or are you just twittering out on your own on that?
Yeah, the project's Twitter feed is MondoNets, and there's also a Tumblr page, and you can find them all at the main MondoNet.org website.
Okay, and you mentioned a book. Want to plug that? What is this, Mashup or something?
Oh, my book? Yeah, my book is called Mashed Up, and you can find details at mashed-up.com. You can also search for it on Google Books. There's a, you know, an ebook edition. It's on Amazon. You know, there's paperback, hardcover. Okay. Should anyone in the universe want to buy a hardcover book?
And what is this book about?
It's about musical culture and the way that music always essentially is a staging ground for arguments about social organization. Uh-huh. And the ways in which emerging forms like mashups are where the current battles over what society is going to look like in the networked age are being waged.
Okay. Interesting. That's pretty nice.
Yeah, so I interview like dozens of DJs and record industry execs. And
oh, that's great.
Like that.
Yeah, I want to check this out. Okay, we're going to close up here. We try to keep this in an hour, but we go over it quite often. I give you the last word. Anything else you want to say about anything before we take off?
Yeah, I just want to reiterate a call to action. You know, we've gotten a lot of email from people who want to be kept abreast of the situation or want to participate in some way. And, you know, what we're looking for most of all right now would be a project partner who is an engineer who has experience with mesh networking and, you know, would participate, obviously, in the call for funding and who we could potentially hire for, you know, contributing to the project for a year.
Okay, great. Oh, you know, and you got the last word there, and then I guess I'm going to throw on another last word. One other thing I'll throw out there to suggest to you is that in all of these systems, there's something that is still needed and might be the only thing that may get a system like this off the ground in a massive way and outside of just people who are interested in using it or volunteers that are running it, and that is an economic incentive. And that doesn't mean that to take this thing into like the corporate to replace the corporate internet with another internet, but there is a possibility with all the new systems out there with anonymous digital cash, that with Bitcoin, open transactions, vouchers, all these new, we have a lot of shows on them, there's anonymous payment systems so that there could be an economic incentive for a lot of people if it was built into the system where you could have thousands or tens of thousands of people that would download this software and run it on their machine, the software from a MondoNet server, and where they could actually be making a little bit of money for providing these public relays and do it anonymously. So there's a market. The market is very important, even if you don't want to. If you want to go away from the big government, corporate, centralized system, on the individual level, economic incentive can play a huge role in some of these new technologies. So it's just an idea I wanted to throw out there, that even if you may not be looking at doing that right now. So
I think that's a great point. We've talked a lot about what would incentivize MONET participation. And I think both financial economic, like Bitcoin, but also economic in the sense of, like, if you look at the way that private file sharing networks have worked, people have to maintain a certain share ratio in order to continue to be members of the network. And so that's another kind of currency, the kind of social capital that gets tracked through your participation. And I think there's absolutely a capacity for that to be built. And let me reemphasize once again along those lines, even to the extent that we will be building MondoNet infrastructure and developing protocols and software, it will all be open. And we're not going to solve every problem. And so, we will continue to publish the line of code we develop. If people want to build, social capital infrastructure, a crowdfunding infrastructure, anything else they want on top of that, not only should they be a guest, but we absolutely believe that will be vital to the success of the project.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for coming on the show today, Aram, and we'll be following your project closely. Thanks for all your good work.
Great. Thanks so much.
Yep. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
All right, everyone. That was a great little interview there. And sorry for the lag and technical issues. Nothing we could do about that today. But we're going to close out here with the Crystal Method winner.
Y'all know. dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.